morning, everyone. And welcome. We'd like to make a start. It's a bit late starting. Just tell us a few things in relation to housekeeping. You already, hopefully, have had a coffee downstairs. You know the coffee in the breaks is provided downstairs. There are toilets out here to the right. And also downstairs, both on the left, and if you go round the corner, to the right, there's another toilet there as well. At lunch, there is a list of restaurants in the local area that you can go to for lunch. Or you're welcome to just purchase a sandwich in Waitrose or from one of the cafes and come back to the museum and sit in the garden. Tickets you have gives you free entry to the museum anytime today. The museum will remain open after the conference finishes for at least 30 minutes or more so that anyone who wants then to go across and see the Art of War exhibition or the museum itself, you're very welcome to. Okay? Yes, and just to say, the origins of today kind of lie back some years ago. One of our speakers this morning, Ellie Roberts, and I set up thing called Children in Troubled Worlds, where we brought together the fields of psychoanalysis, literature and the arts, and since 2003 have been running generally annual conferences relating to this theme. And then a couple of years ago, Janet Boland, who's here today, a theatre director, and myself, put on a series of conversations called Between the Lines, conversations between psychoanalysts, psychotherapists and poets and writers, and some of the speakers today, David Constantine, Sam Willits, have been part of that series in Oxford. And it was Ivan who, a couple of years ago, said, the series you ran in Oxford has three evening events. Could you please come and run them as a conference? So last year we had the first Psychoanalytic Poetry Festival. And this is our second. And it's wonderful to have it in, wonderful as it is to do it in Oxford. It's so much nicer to do it in connection with the Freud Museum and, of course, Indiana Freud Center. There's so much wonderful work has been done with children and families over the years. I'm going to hand over to Judith Power, who's director of the Poetry Society. Yes? Talk a little bit louder, or perhaps the volume needs to go up. I'm going to hand over now. But I'll remember that when I'm back up one later. Thank you.
And I'm going to practice with volume and hope that some people wave if they can see my mouth moving but are unaware that there are words and they can't get them. So I'm Judith Palmer, I'm director of the Poetry Society, and from our point of view how this came about, there's this thing called National Poetry Day, which is itself a sort of memorial, monumental thing. It's the first Thursday of October, and the theme for it this year was Remember. The theme was set last year, and the minute the theme was set of Remember, I thought, I must contact the Freud Museum and see if we can do something on the theme. And obviously we've been thinking very much about the centenary of the First World War. And so this came together through conversations with Jerry Byrne, who's just been speaking, who's a child, I'm sure many of you know, but for any who doesn't, he's a child psychotherapist based in Oxford. And with Ivan Ward from the Freud Museum. And so we've been having conversations for a year, and some of the poets you're going to hear today are the psychoanalyst's pick, and some of the poets' pick. We all have chosen the same people, but just so as you know, it's been a group choice of people to hear from. The bookshop wanted to let me to mention that in the coffee break that's coming up this morning, they're going to bring over a few of the books that they have just to show you that there are books. There are reminders that there are books all around you, but that there are books. And then, so they'll have some here in the coffee break, but they've got a wonderful bookstall at the Freud Museum across the road, which is one of the best bookshops in London, especially for everything. There is not an occasion for which you cannot find something in that shop, as I know to my cost. Anyway, we're going to begin this morning. We're very pleased to have with us Dr. Stephen Wilson. You can clap yet more in a moment. Stephen was one of the first people that sprang to mind because he has written short studies, both of Freud. World War poet Isaac Rosenberg. So this seemed, for no other reason, a key person to have opening the event today. Stephen Wilson was formerly a consultant psychiatrist at both the Littlemore and Warnford hospitals and senior clinical lecturer in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Oxford. He's a psychoanalytic psychotherapist, and I know him as a writer, which is why I have to do the make sure I get the hospitals right bit there. I know him as a writer and as a poet, and being closely involved with the Poetry Society as well. His short study of Isaac Rosenberg, published by Greenwich Exchange, is going to form the basis of today's talk, which is remembering Isaac Rosenberg. Please join me in welcoming Stephen Wilson.
Well, thank you very much. Good morning and welcome. I hope you'll forgive me from reading this presentation from notes. Freud always was famous for never using them, and I can't do that, and I don't want to do a David Miliband. So, I've called this talk Remembering Isaac Rosenberg. By the way, can you hear me at the back? Yes? Okay, good. I called it Remembering Isaac Rosenberg because I want to emphasize the reconstructive aspects, the selecting and piecing together of parts that memory entails. And I like the idea of putting Rosenberg back together because he was killed in action and his remains were never reliably identified. Now, memory is most often thought of as an individual process, frequently accurate but notoriously open to unconscious falsification. On the other hand, memorialization is a social process and unashamedly tendentious. We want to celebrate and remember heroes and high achievers. Presenting biographical material is a form of memorialization, and in my view, it occupies a position somewhere in the triangle bounded by history, fiction, and gossip. It's a literary genre, probably best described as dodgy realism. And since we're here in the Anna Freud Center, we should also heed Freud's own words on the subject. Whoever undertakes to write a biography binds himself to lying, to concealment, to hypocrisy, to flummery, and even to hiding his own lack of understanding. So I confess it all. What I'm about to say is my own construction. But I tried to use a lot of Rosenberg's words. It's mainly about the poet and his life as a soldier. And not at all the psychoanalytic, you'll be pleased to know, for this time in the morning. But let's at least start with a piece of evidence. Rosenberg was born in Bristol in 1890 to a family of Yiddish-speaking Russian Jewish immigrants. You probably can't see it, but you may just be able to see that his father's occupation is given as licensed hawker. And in the space where his signature should be, there is a cross where the registrar has written the mark of Barnett Rosenberg, father, 5 Adelaide Place, Bristol, indicating that Barnett was unable to sign his name in English. 7 years later, the impoverished family, parents and 5 children, soon to be 6, moved into one room at the back of a rag and bones shop situated in Cable Street, in the heart of the Jewish East End of London. Now, Rosenberg was singled out at an early age as an unusually talented boy, a special case, and wherever he was, he always sought to establish his unique credentials as painter and poet. His poverty meant that he left school at the age of 14 to work in a firm of engravers, where he spent the following 5 years. He hated every minute of it. He scarcely earned any money during the whole of his short life, relying mainly on patronage and loans for his living and for fees at Birkbeck College and the Slade School of Art, with all the ambivalent emotions that such relationships bring. When he did eventually decide to join up in October 1915, at the age of 24, he did so not in a fit of patriotic fervour, but as he wrote, with no more free will than a tree, because he would receive an income of a shilling a day, and in addition, he believed that his mother would receive what they called a separation allowance from the government, some extra money, although he scarcely fulfilled the criterion of having provided regular financial support for a reasonable period of time. He enlisted in the... I keep looking over there to make sure the right slide is on when I'm talking. He enlisted in the army at the end of October 1915. Although he understood his family would have to know, he withheld the news, fearing the distress it would produce. When he finally wrote, he placated his parents with the white lie that he had signed on for home service only. Now, the pressing need for infantrymen had driven the government to recruit cannon fodder into bantam battalions. Bantams, named after the small, sturdy fighting cock, and initially drawn from men who were short in stature, yet tough and strong. But by the time Rosenberg joined the 12th Battalion of the Suffolk Regiment, part of the newly created 40th Division, the criteria had been relaxed. Recruits were now taken from those whose general physique was obviously unequal to the strain of military service. He found himself among a motley crew of inadequates, a horrible rabble. Falstaff scarecrows were nothing to these, he wrote to Edward Marsh, one of his patrons. 3 out of every 4 have been scavengers, and the 4th is a ticket of leave. In fact, over 80% of 1,000 new recruits were weeded out before the battalion saw active service. Rosenberg, with his weak chest, tendency to daydream, unpolished buttons, often done up in the wrong buttonholes, and anti-authoritarian personality, wasn't one of them. Now, equipped with a suit on his back, a comb, a handkerchief, a copy of John Donne's poems, and Sir Thomas Browne's Religio Medici, the spiritual testament of a 17th century doctor, Rosenberg was sent to Bury St. Edmunds for training. He wasn't the ideal recruit, but then nor were any of the others. He had to wait weeks for his uniform and kit to arrive and to subsist on meagre rations. He had to eat out of a basin together with some horribly smelling scavenger who spits and sneezes into it. And he was under the immediate command of a little impudent schoolboy pup who had taken again him, possibly for anti-Semitic reasons. Sir Thomas's Christian principles that invoked the general charity I owed unto humanity as rather to hate than pity Turks, infidels, and what is worse, Jews, appear to be of little comfort. Rosenberg was issued with boots, and either wasn't told or didn't pay attention to advice on how to soften the leather. Apparently soaking them in urine was a frequently used method. Consequently, he was in agony on long route marches. He developed swollen feet and a hole about an inch round in his heel that probably caused him to trip over during a running exercise in front of the colonel. He ended up in hospital with severely cut hands under the care of a Major Devereux, a ridiculous, bullying brute of a doctor. Sidney Schiff, another wealthy patron, sent money that Rosenberg spent on new boots, shaves, and suppers. He also sent watercolours that Rosenberg used to capture his comrades' likenesses, and cigarettes that he shared with them. Edward Marsh sent chocolates, and Miss Seaton, a schoolmistress who had become Rosenberg's long-standing confidant, sent books. Extraordinarily, within a month, he had come to value his military life, writing to Marsh, "I don't object to severe duties or menial and filthy work, as it hardens me," and to Schiff, "One might succumb, be destroyed, but one might also, and the chances are even greater for it, be renewed, made larger, healthier." It was as if... Oh, it hasn't been... Well, yes, it was as if he felt the need for some searing experience that would catalyze a moral and artistic regeneration. In this elevated mood, he composed Marching as Seen from the Left File, a poem that surely encapsulates both the seductive aesthetic of military power and the horrifying violence of mechanized war. "My eyes catch ruddy necks, sturdily pressed back, all a red brick moving glint, like flaming pendulums, hands swing across the khaki, mustard-coloured khaki to the automatic feet. We husband the ancient glory in these bared necks and hands. Not broke is the forge of Mars, but a subtler brain beats iron to shoe the hoofs of death. Who pours dynamic air now? Blind fingers, loose an iron cloud to rain immortal darkness on strong eyes." Now, I'm sure you're familiar with these scenes. The Western Front stretched nearly 500 miles from Switzerland to the Channel coast of Belgium. Millions of soldiers were entrenched along both sides with an area of no man's land, sometimes as narrow as 30 yards separating the armies. Behind the front line that was protected with the newly employed military technology known as barbed wire were backup trenches where reserve forces could be held in readiness for combat. Dugouts were excavated in the trench walls that provided cramped space for shelter and sleep. And behind the trenches were supply depots, field hospitals, and military headquarters. And intensive fighting did not occur everywhere at the same time, but the threat of death from poison gas, sniper fire, heavy artillery, or unexpected raiding parties was ever present. Small stretches of ground were lost and retaken at terrible cost, while the remaining soldiers continued their daily life against the bizarre normality of dead bodies, mud, rats, lice, and boredom. Now into this Dantean landscape was projected Private Isaac Rosenberg, A Company, 11th S Battalion, King's Own Royal Lancaster Regiment, British Expeditionary Force, who, not surprisingly, had lost all his socks before leaving England. One thing that enabled soldiers to preserve a sense of connection with the world they had left behind was an efficient postal service. This really surprised me, but on average, letters took no more than 2 days to get between the home front and the Western Front. I think we'd be lucky if we could do that today. Rosenberg was able to communicate with his family, friends, and patrons. He was able to receive parcels and to submit work to Harriet Monroe in Chicago. Albeit the censor forbade him to send poems home because he couldn't, quote, be bothered with going through such rubbish, Rosenberg took no notice. There are 80 published letters that date from the 22 months he spent in the trenches, and there were certainly others no longer extant. So this extraordinary selfie typifying his dreamy, almost fey appearance in the trenches and wry humour was sent to the poet R.C. Trevelyan in June 1916. Now, you can just about make out a tin of marmalade next to what looks like a small rat or mouse at the bottom of the drawing. The labelled areas, bottom right, read Black Beetles and Rats Headquarters. And at top right, it reads Fleas Reservoir and Fleas Headquarters. Rosenberg's holographs, written on scraps of muddied paper, arrived home regularly, where his sister Annie lovingly typed them out and returned them for further editing. Shortly after arriving in France, he wrote Miss Seaton, "I've been in trouble with bad heels. You can't have the slightest conception of what such an apparently trivial thing means. We've had shells bursting 2 yards off, bullets whizzing all over the show, but all you are aware of is the agony in your heels." Rosenberg's mother sent socks and underwear. Miss Seaton sent novels. Schiff sent newspapers and books. Even Mrs. Cohen, another of his wealthy patrons with whom he had fallen out years before, unexpectedly sent him a volume of poems which she herself had published. In a physical environment fraught with danger, it is no exaggeration to suggest that Rosenberg owed his psychological survival to the power of poetry. But he paid for his dreamy preoccupation, being frequently punished for unsoldierly conduct, on one occasion for forgetting to put on his gas mask. His chances of living nearly 2 years would have been severely diminished were it not for the intervention of his family, who asked Marsh, the high-ranking civil servant and close associate of Winston Churchill, to use his influence in order to get Isaac posted away from the front. Now, Plato objected to poetry on the grounds that it famously on the grounds that it undermined young men's courage by giving expression to emotions, to weakness. And Shelley, however, believed that poetry had a transformative effect, an enabling function, that in a secret alchemy allowed the poisonous waters that flow from death through life to be converted into potable gold. Rosenberg's attitude was nearer to Shelley's. He saw poems as a vehicle for the modulation and expression of everyday experience. Poetry was a metamorphic process that forged new forms from the nexus of inner and outer worlds. His commitment to his art surmounted all other concerns. "I will not leave a corner of my consciousness covered up," he wrote to Lawrence Binyon, "but saturate myself with the strange and extraordinary new conditions of this life, and it will all refine itself into poetry later on. Painful experience could be tolerated, even valued, as the material out of which poems were made." His famous poem, "Break of Day in the Trenches," was written soon after he arrived in France, and "Dead Man's Dump," perhaps the most harrowing poem to emerge from the war, derived from his duties as a Royal Engineer almost a year later. The repair of barbed wire fences was carried out under cover of night. It involved moving mule carts packed with wire coils and metal stakes up to the front line and on into no man's land. And one macabre consequence was the likelihood of running over dead bodies. "I wrote a poem about some dead Germans lying in a sunken road where we dumped our wire," Rosenberg told the poet Gordon Bottomley. "I have asked my sister to send it on to you, though I think it commonplace." In fact, he had made a truly awesome poem. Although there are nods to Keats and recurrences of his favourite words, scepters, veins, etc., his distinctive language transcends them. Laden with poetic tropes in a chaos of arresting images, crucifixion allusions, empathy with the enemy, end rhyme, internal rhyme, visual rhyme, anaphoric repetitions and broken rhythms, the poem graphically conveys the human devastation in which he was mired. The first three stanzas lead us into a work of unprecedented candor. No other poet had given such an arresting close-up before. "The plunging limbers over the shattered track, racketed with their rusty freight, stuck out like many crowns of thorns, and the rusty stakes like scepters old to stay the flood of brutish men upon our brothers dear. The wheels lurched over sprawled dead, but pained them not, though their bones crunched, their shut mouths made no moan. They lie there huddled, friend and foeman, man born of man and born of woman, and shells go crying over them from night till night, and now earth has waited for them all the time of their growth, fretting for their decay. Now she has them, at last, in the strength of their strength, suspended, stopped, and held." Rosenberg portrays the earth as waiting impatiently to receive dead souls, their containing bodies strewn on the ground like empty sacks. Lines like, somewhere they must have gone and flung on your hard back is their soul's sack, emptied of God ancestral essences. Who hurled them out? Who hurled? And his shook shoulders slipped their load, but when they went to look again, the drowning soul was sunk too deep for human tenderness. In my mind, compare with Gerard Manley Hopkins, though it is pretty certain that Rosenberg had never seen any of his work. Didn't seem to get this button very well.
I think you went over to the slides then, yeah.
No, that's not the right one.
Is
it? Really?
Yeah.
No. If I could go back to the one I had.
Like a highborn maybe?
Yeah, that's what I want. Thank you. Yeah, in Rosenberg's finely crafted poem, Returning We Hear the Larks, the relief at being still alive at the end of the night's work in no man's land is tempered by the knowledge that arriving back at the trenches offers only relative safety. But it is not, as the title might suggest, a romantic celebration of lark song. Unlike Shelley's Skylark, whose voice is like a high-born maiden in a palace tower, soothing her love-laden soul in secret hour, with music sweet as love, which overflows her bower. Rosenberg's bird drops its song, like a blind man's dreams on the sand by dangerous tides, like a girl's dark hair, for she dreams no ruin lies there, or her kisses where a serpent hides. In a thoroughly modernist and strikingly original treatment of the subject, he has taken the objective danger in his environment and fused it with the deeply felt internal danger that derives from his dread of woman. But there is an ambiguity. The girl herself may be equally at risk, or at least is exonerated from blame, for she is unaware of what her dark hair conceals. Dreams, no ruin lies there. The theme is also elaborated in Daughters of War, of which there are 7 different versions. Rosenberg considered it his best poem. He worked on it from autumn 1916 and completed the final draft the following year. It deals with the 2 principal preoccupations of most writers and probably all soldiers, sex and death. Once again, in line with his ambivalent bonding to women, he constructs a mythical scenario in which immortal Amazonian maidens force the souls out of dead male bodies in order to take them for lovers. Even these must leap to the love heat of these maidens from the flame of Terrene days, leaving grey ashes to the wind, to the wind. The End, he wrote Marsh in June 1917, is an attempt to imagine the severance of all human relationship and the fading away of human love. No doubt it was a way of using art to come to terms with his situation. personifying a sexualized soul engaged with an Amazon in some kind of sensual afterlife, both spiritual and voluptuous at the same time, was a strange yet comforting fantasy. But Rosenberg certainly didn't believe in it. In reality, he was more inclined to Lucretius' views, written around 50 BC, that in true death there is no second self alive and able to sorrow for self-destroyed. R.C. Trevelyan had sent him a copy of his translation of the Roman poet, to which Rosenberg responded, "Hamlet's inquiring nature, so mixed with theology, superstition, penetration, may be more human and general, but Lucretius, as a mood, definite, is fine, proud philosophy. I can say no more than that I got deep pleasure from it." On the 14th of September, 1917, having had a bath behind the lines and been issued with a clean uniform, Rosenberg set off for a period of 10 days' leave in London. He was keen to be reunited with family and friends. He hoped to meet Bottomley and Trevelyan, with whom he had only ever corresponded. And he wanted to complete The Unicorn, an extraordinary verse play about a decaying race who had never seen women. "Animals take the place of women," he explained to Bottomley, "but the race yearns for continuity. The plot, that could only have been devised by a sex-starved soldier, would end with, I quote, a host of blacks on horses like centaurs and buffaloes, each one clasping a woman, rushing up and sweeping Lilith onto the chief's unicorn, after which they would all ride away into the distance. The fantastical storyline, however, conceals a profound struggle on Rosenberg's part to reconcile war experience with belief in the redemptive nature of beauty, sexual violence with sexual love. Lilith, I think there is more sorrow in the world than man can bear. Nubian, none can exceed their limit, lady. You either bear or break. Lilith, can one choose to break? To bear, to wearily bear in misery. Beauty is this corroding malady. Nubian, beauty is a great paradox. Music, secret soul, creeping about the senses. To wrestle with man's coarser nature, it is hard when beauty loses." But the abrupt change of environment was disorientating. Rosenberg found himself restless, unable to read or write, and bewildered by the prospect of fitting so many things into such a brief respite. He had his photograph taken in a studio together with his brother Elkon, who was also on leave from the army. Gordon Bottomley and Trevelyan were away, and Schiff was out when he called. Nonetheless, he continued to make a round of his old haunts, the Slade, the Café Royal, and he managed to meet up with Marsh. He went to the theatre, and he may have seen Old Flames, Annetta Raphael, and Sonia Cohen. He was on a high, so much so that his withdrawn character appeared radically changed. His friend, Joseph Leftwich, who was hailed by him in the street, later recalled, "I was walking along the road when I heard someone running behind me. It was Rosenberg in uniform. He had been on a bus going home from the station to see his mother, and he had caught sight of me and jumped off. He was more boisterously happy than I had ever known him before, and he was noisily indignant because he had heard that some people had been saying that he hated the army and he wanted to wangle his way out. It was not true, he clamoured. He liked the life and the boys, and he had to fight." This is terrible. But anyway, Soon after returning to the front, Rosenberg caught the flu. His condition was severe enough. I need to go back.
You've gone 5 minutes over already.
Okay, right. Almost free.
Yeah.
Now go forward. Yeah. So any luck that he felt at having got out of this late stunt was to be short-lived, and by January 1918 he was back in the trenches with a broken spirit. "I seem powerless to compel my will to any direction," he wrote Miss Seton. "All I do is without energy and interest." 3 weeks later he continued, "I do not feel that I have much to say, but I know that unless I write now, it will be a long time before you hear from me again." In the early hours of the 1st of April, after a period of heavy fighting, he was on his way back to the reserve trenches when he answered a call for volunteers to return to the front line, and he was killed in close combat. I'll just very briefly go through a little bit about the memorialization. Advance. 10 years later, the Imperial War Graves Commission located an unmarked grave near Fompu, in which the remains of several soldiers on the same burial list as Rosenberg were identified. In October 28, they were reinterred in the Bayeux Road East Cemetery near Arras. A stone bearing Rosenberg's name above a Star of David was erected, and the words "artist and poet" also appear, for which extra engraving the commission charged his family 3 shillings and 3 pence. Advance. In 1959, Rosenberg's sister, Mrs. Annie Wynick, donated this self-portrait to the National Portrait Gallery. Painted in 1915, it shows the head and shoulders of the artist with his eyes staring directly out to the viewer, and is the final portrait that Rosenberg completed of himself, wearing his distinctive Tyrolean broad-brimmed hat, a symbol, some think, of his release from wage slavery in Henschel's print shop and entry into the world of art. Next. On 11th of November 85, Ted Hughes, the poet laureate, unveiled a memorial stone in Poets' Corner, Westminster Abbey, commemorating poets of the First World War. 16 are mentioned by name, including Isaac Rosenberg. Next. In 1987, English Heritage put up a blue plaque outside Whitechapel Public Library, where Rosenberg had studied. Next. And earlier this year, the Royal Mail announced a 5-year program of stamps to commemorate the First World War. Some of them will represent the work of poets. The first stamp, showing famous lines from Laurence Binion, has already appeared. Less famous lines from Rosenberg will appear in 2017. I'm not allowed to show you the proposed image from the forthcoming stamp, which is strictly embargoed, but the Royal Mail have kindly permitted me to show you their artist's initial suggestion, subsequently very much modified. Clearly fitting poems onto stamps is not easy and inevitably involves tampering with the line breaks, but they have done a good job. The quote is from Dead Man's Dump, the very poem he had casually mentioned to Bottomley as being commonplace. What would he have thought? Next. There are plans to erect a statue in Torrington Square, Bloomsbury, close to the two great learning centres in Rosenberg's life. The chosen sculptor is Etienne Milner. Rosenberg will stand tall at last, despite his own comment on King George V's inspection before his division left for France. "The King inspected us Thursday," I believe it's the 1st Bantam Brigade been inspected. He must have waited a long time for us to stand up. At a distance, we look like soldiers sitting down. You know, legs so short. Next. £92,000 needs to be raised in order for the statue to be unveiled on 1st of April 2018, the centenary of Rosenberg's disappearance from the Western Front. So if you're feeling generous...
Thank you very much, Steve. Thank you. I just want to let you know we are recording things today. We'd like you to feel free to talk. So if you would be free to talk, and then let us know if there is anything that you have said that you would rather be unmemorialised, then we shall do it, but let it not prevent you. We're running a little bit late, but I'm going to just do a couple of minutes. Does anyone have anything that they particularly like to ask Steve at this point? There's so much that it brings up. I've always loved that fact that Steve mentioned that it cost an extra £3 to be memorialised as a poet and artist. Had he had a singular career, they could have saved
three and threepence.
If he'd just been a poet or just an artist, they could have saved themselves a shilling. John?
Yeah, I would just like to ask moving more perhaps into the realms of psychoanalysis, what do we think the value of memorialising a figure, any figure, Rosenberg, we're talking about now, so may as well be here, is for us now? You know, what sort of redemptive value is it going to have for us socially?
I don't know whether anyone else in the audience wants to answer that. I don't know. We do it. We're human beings and we like to memorialise people. And as I said earlier, you know, we like to have heroes and to celebrate people's lives. And most of it is probably quite tendentious and quite... we select, we create images of people. I don't know what other people think. Why do we memorialise people?
I mean, in putting it back together, is there a sort of collective guilt there as well in this, that we are remembering him because we feel guilty somehow collectively for these young men's destruction? I don't know,
it's
those kind of thoughts.
Well, I don't think, guilt may have something to do with it, but I don't think that is necessarily a general motive for memorialising anybody. You know, there are lots of people we memorialise that we don't feel guilty about. But I like to, you know, the idea of remembering, putting back together, reconstructing, since you asked about psychoanalysis, I probably ought to also say that Melanie Klein was very hot on the idea of reparation as the root of a deep root of constructive processes in the individual human psyche.
Thanks. I think just in order to move along, we'll sort of just halt this discussion before it even gets probably going, but keep all the thoughts in you, and we will bring them forth later. So thank you very much, Steve. So, one of the things I think about very much in terms of this is while listening to your talk, is that sense of thank you very much for bringing Rosenberg to life. This is the thing that you always, when somebody tells you about someone you didn't know you know, you think, thank you for bringing them to life, the very things you are not able to do, but through talking and writing, of course, we are. Now, the next person we are to resuscitate is Helen Thomas. And to do that is the poet Derren Rees-Jones. Derren Rees-Jones is Professor of Poetry at Liverpool University. Ideas of memory have been there throughout all of her poetry. Her earliest collection is called The Memory Tray. Her last collection, Burying the Wren, is a series of elegies. And her latest book is this, And You, Helen. It is a book about Helen Thomas, and it came out of a research project in Ledbury, got going by the Ledbury Festival, and was made, Derren will tell you about it, but there's also a short film that was made as part of this project, which Derren is going to show. I'm just going to now pass you over. Thank you, Derren.
I hope everybody can hear. Yeah, I've got quite a quiet voice. So I thought actually I'd, in the spirit of free association, I wouldn't write anything down actually, because I think this project for me has been something about improvising and working something through personally, but also picking up on this idea of what we remember, how we remember, and who we remember. So Helen Thomas was the wife of Edward Thomas. It was interesting to see him there, memorialised on the list of soldiers. I've actually got a war memorial right outside my office of a young man, Noel Shabazz, who won, I think, the Victoria Cross twice. And I have to negotiate that statue every time I go into work. And it hits me quite hard, because it's a sort of statue that's very solid, it's in bronze, but it's about him frozen in this instant of action. It's him doing something brave and immediate. And what I really feel rankles me is I want a statue on the other side of the square that I also have to negotiate, which is about what happened to the women who were waiting and anticipating and having to hold everything together while their partners or sons were away, and had to deal with everything that happened when they didn't come home, or had to deal with what happened when they did come home. So I was very interested in Helen Thomas, Edward Thomas's wife, because she is such a resilient, interesting character, but because she also took it on herself to memorialise Edward's life. And actually, she was key in carrying on his reputation, publishing the poems, and writing these two memoirs after his death. And they were very important processes for her, I think, as a widow. So I thought I would just read you this poem that the book takes its title from. And it's a poem that Edward Thomas wrote for Helen. He was thinking very much about what was going to happen, very much anticipating the fact that he would die as a soldier. And he wrote a series of poems for his family, one for each of his three children, and then the final one for her. And they're very odd poems to my mind, because he's clearly thinking of leaving something behind for them. But he's also recognising his sort of failures as a father and a husband. And so they're all I would haves. And he's sort of sending them into the future of anticipated death. So he says, you know, I would give you this, and I would have done this. And because they're a family living in such extreme poverty, you know, he's wanting to give them nature and money and things that he hasn't been able to provide. And they sit in a funny place for me. You know, they sort of get round the fact that he didn't do things as well. And the last poem he wrote is the only one where he puts any of his family's names in the poem, And You, Helen. And from what I understand, he wrote it, handed it to her, and then walked out. He wasn't going to sit with her as she read it. And again, I find it's a very painful poem. I'll read it to you. and you, Helen. And you, Helen, what should I give you? So many things I would give you, had I an infinite great store offered me, and I stood before to choose. I would give you youth, all kinds of loveliness and truth, a clear eye as good as mine, lands, waters, flowers, wine, as many children as your heart might wish for, a far better art than mine can be, all you have lost upon the travelling waters tossed, or given to me. If I could choose freely in that great treasure house, anything from any shelf, I would give you back yourself, and power to discriminate what you want and want it not too late. Many fair days free from care, and heart to enjoy both foul and fair, and myself too, if I could find where it lay hidden, and it proved kind. Now, that poem set off all sorts of irritations in me, as well as recognitions that it's a very brilliant poem. All the things that you couldn't give, so I'm giving them to you in a poem, and I've got the poem at the end of this too, but still I haven't given you these things properly. Helen was very short-sighted, and that line about wanting to give her sight as good as his, again, got lots of things going for me, because there's a huge sense of ownership of her in that poem. I would give you back yourself. Sort of suggests that she hasn't got herself in the first place. And this dynamic between them is fascinating and painful, really. She spends an awful lot of time on her own with the children while he's off, and is suffering, clearly, horrors of depression and unhappiness. And it's only really in the last 2 years of his life that he starts to write. So there's always a space between them, lots of letters exchanged, and she is a huge optimist. And one of the things I wanted to try and get my head around, really, was why she does endure so much in this marriage, how she manages still to remain so resilient in the face of it all and the difficulties, and then what she does afterwards as well, when she's trying to reconstruct really what their marriage was, what it meant to her, how she's trying to mourn. Because the memoirs that came out, he died in 1970. This poem was written a year to the day that he died. She published the memoir in 1926, as it was, and World Without End in 1931. And those were very popular, but they were written under the initials HT. She had the characters in the book weren't Edward and Helen, they were Jenny and David. And it wasn't until 1972 that a key was put in the Carcanet edition saying, well, actually, this is Edward Thomas and this is Helen Thomas. And then it wasn't until 1988 that actually their names were put in those memoirs. So there's all sorts of complexities and things that I kept running up against. In the book, I say, you know, I can't get answers to this, and that's why I'm interested in it. So I wanted to think about biography. I was interested in what Stephen was quoting the Freud about flummery and the fact that, you know, you're hiding things from yourself that you don't know as a biographer. And in the essay that's in this book, I wanted to think about, you know, why am I doing this? What's the point of doing this? How am I doing it? What does it mean to me? I was interested in Helen as a widow because I'm also a widow. And it seemed that I just wanted to keep hitting those points of no answer, actually. And I think the book doesn't give any answers either, but it's the process that I'm interested in. Shall I say a little bit more? So the poem that I've written in response, And You, Helen, is really trying to think about what it was like after Helen found that Edward was dead. She never saw his body. She received a telegram telling her that this had happened. Obviously, she was anticipating it. I think, you know, both of them were aware that this was very likely. And I wrote a 12-part sequence. And what I really wanted to capture was that sense of movement between the present and being in a place, and the way in which we hold memories in lots of complex and concurrent ways. And I was very interested in what she saw, you know, this idea of giving her back to herself or giving her back herself. What would that mean? What would happen if I tried to find a way to finding her as a self, for example? And it's the first time really that I've written about somebody as a she. I would often use an I, the lyric I is somewhere I'm happy, the dramatic monologue. But somehow this became a poem of she doing things. And it's long and baggy, and I wanted there to be lots of space, lots of room for this poem to happen in. And I wanted to structure it musically, so there are lots of repeats and refrains. And I also wanted to take stuff from her memoirs, which are threaded through textually. So I'm interested, for example, you know, one of the things that happened in the joyful things between Edward and Helen was that he found a way of getting her to see the world again. She kind of writes about that. And he named the world, the birds and the animals and the trees and the grasses. And it was very much a relationship rooted in knowing nature. So she threads those things through her memoirs. And, you know, if you have a word like loosestrife, willow grass, I wanted to see what happened as you kept repeating that throughout the poem, because of course the word changes, the sound remains the same, the meaning shifts because of its context. And I wanted to push that as far as I could musically. I think that was the plan, anyway. And what was great about this collaboration, and I've never done this kind of intense collaboration. Usually with a collaboration, it's a sort of brief exchange, and people do their own thing and sort of have a conversation about it afterwards, was that when I was working with Charlotte Hobbs, we did sit down and I looked at rough notes, things I would never dream of showing anybody in the world, but I showed Charlotte, and she'd say, what are you doing? What does that mean? How does that work? And then she'd go away and draw. And I drove her mad, I think, because I would put a sparrow in a poem, she'd draw a sparrow, and I'd take sparrow out, very easy on the word processor. She still had a sparrow. And she said, what am I going to do with the sparrow? And I said, keep the sparrow. The sparrow's sitting there because the sparrow was there. It doesn't really matter that it's not there in language. So it's a very, very fruitful dialogue for me. Charlotte works in collage, and I was very interested in this idea of drawing and then cutting up, dismantling, reassembling, which was something I think that I was doing textually as well. It's a big build-up. I hope the poem sort of... I hope you understand the poem because I've talked about it rather than I'm unravelling the poem. But we made a film with a young animator called Christina Pulyakova. So they were busy working, I was busy writing, and then Charlotte was also doing collages that sit alongside the poems. Again, it's that emphasis on, you know, I would give you back your vision, your sight. I wanted there to be a lot of sense of dialogue between what you see and what you write and what you feel. So it's felt like an enormous project. Perhaps if we see the film, and then if anybody would like to ask any questions, if you like. It's 15 minutes. Yeah, 15 minutes.
Ivan, should we put that line down as well?
Yeah, that's a bit
And you, Helen. Can the loose drive make us a home? Can the skylark, stuttering, sing and be known to us? Can the bee creaturely dodging the breeze? Can the dragonfly with her wings of glass? Can the bitter leaf and sweet grasses, grass seeds, meadowsweet and chickweed? Can the ants and woodlice, wind-blown burrs? Can the spider, assembling herself, pull threads of silver one to another? Celandine, catkins, and orchard bound in mistletoe. Can the moth alert at our edges? Can a butterfly, rising and gliding in the powdery nettle beds? Can the shadow of the oak tree, casting itself from green to black? Even as the sky darkens, can the hare, stilled at the field's edge, nervy, watching, bring us an answer? I answer yes, and love hunkers down, shows us her great mercy. At first, she sees nothing. Darkness robs at her, star blasted, dream filled, knocking her sideways from love, out of sleep. None of this knows itself, slow, forming. Now it is morning, and so there's a shift, when dark is an opening, a heartbeat on darkness, pulse, pulse. This is her mind, connecting with feeling, with thought, with a memory, memory of thought. Loose drive, nettles. She fumbles in spaces, can sense in the half-light the breath of her children. Her body takes root. Her body takes hold. Roses blacken in a jug at the bedside. Ash in the grate remembers its fire. Now it is morning. Yet still there is nothing. Nothing. But a space beside her. Nothing but a space inside. The oak tree knows the field, the bend of its shadow to the grass. It knows the sun's path, passage of blackcap, starling, brook. How to clutch a song and nest it in leaf. It knows the ant that labours up grass blades, a stag beetle glinting, passage of worms. The tree surrenders its shadow to shadows. Oak tree and field converse in the shadow grass. Here is how shadows bend. Here is where birds rise. Birds rise up. Had the night known itself, darkness, it would have opened wide its mouth, afraid. Two men walk across the field. Her heart beat like a missed step. August wears ghost cells, and the shadow of one keeps on walking into shadow, while the shadow of one lies down. Pause. Moth flutter. Like shadow broken loose, carving grey in the moonlight. First you hear rain, then you imagine it, seeing how rain might drum at its brokenness, drums inside. A man feels the dark field singing through his bones. She feels it too, rain singing, love singing. Here now are its broken lines. Here, in a heartbeat, the white explosion. A body lies, thickening with mud. And the dead who are long gone open up their mouths. The rain, the field, every small thing it owns. Where he is, stumbles. Although she can imagine him, pulls lovingly a thread. His voice, silence, breaks in the listening, widens, stretches. A hair quivers like an unearthed wire. Hush. While the field moves, she's complete in her listening. Rain on the roof makes eaves a dull listening. Then thunder dolls, and the sky splits. She's dreaming of journeys and trains through darkness. Elder, dogwood, flaming maple, pulls at a thread. As this old tin bowl holds water for washing, it holds too the memory of water. As her body holds the memory of, she holds too. As a gun holds the memory of its firing, as the earth soaks up water, sends it skyward, as the skylark, as the fieldfare, sparrow, blackcap, rook, as her body holds his body, as their slow, deep movements, he holds too. As milk burns in the breast, remembering the tug of, as their bodies are a bridge, and children call to her out of their sleep, as her collarbone, as her pelvic bone, as her everything holds, as the horses, as the, as she wakes from a dream, as shrapnel, as mud. Where she is, stumbles. Her fingers move to the edges of her body, negotiate the space at her clavicle. She holds the full weight of her breast in her hands. She cannot feel much more than this. When she wakes, she reaches for the space. Is it always like this? Each step, as if each bare foot on the wooden stairs might suddenly explode. So field edge touches sky edge. So a pair of sparrows squabble in the corn stooks. Somewhere between the grain field and the dusk dark, between grass song, her whisperings and tree song, the talking of the leaves, a body hangs in a moment. Here is the moment between living and dying, the space beyond, and the space inside. She stretches out her limbs and there is a conversation taking place. The space beyond, the space inside. Does the breeze pull a thread of hair across the brow? Does the movement of the blood around the body, stoppered by the earth's stop, run to a halt? Do the lungs expand after death to this? And is silence then its own sound? Does she wait now for an exhalation? Does a wheeze of breath come at the very end, overdue? Does a wren, caught beneath a hedgerow, suddenly appear? Fieldfare, sparrow, rook. There's blood at the throat. Whose throat? His body is perfect. Only his heart, as if caught in the split of a second, catching its breath. He gives her a look. Pause. The skies light up. Is this the way she might imagine him? Poem's feather in his pocket. Birdsong. Here is the stillness of robin or redstart called palely to his palm. The memory of a memory. That last night returns to her. Fragments melting in nudges of firelight. His hand touches without somehow touching any human part of her. It is like this. This slow, gorgeous climbing and gathering. This entering. This being inside. White clover, yellow bed straw, milk wort. She drops a glass. And now her face, as if something at her heart had spilled through a crack, singing like an ice floe in the darkness, widens, holds. What she holds for their children. But now there is breakage, the terrible shifting ocean of herself let out. Goosestrife, nettles. She'd unbuttoned her blouse, letting her clothes fall loose to the waist, then pull in a circle, shoulder straps, underclothes. She makes his body as she guides his hands, a poem. The sun a covering, the sky a covering, their two bodies in one movement, a poem in the grass. She remembers the day he turned tight on his heel, took a gun in his hand to walk out to the woods. The children's eyes blackened like wounds in the darkness, and her own heart split. She wonders at the fury of endurance. Where to place love? Sinew, curve, edge, vein. Love cooks, digs, sews, binds, smooths, irons, cleans, wrenching from tiredness, dirt, a tenderness. When they lie together in the night, it is something like this. Pulse. Rain furies, dances, sings. If he sees the world through her eyes, then she sees the world through his. He has gathered her up in his old greatcoat. Can he carry her, she wonders, like the girl she was, in his officer's coat, with his freshly razored hair? Mosses grow on the furzy green. Her red dress tears like a wound in a wound. He has gathered her up and will sing to her under the shadow of the deep-breasted oak. Listen. This is the sound of his tread on the stairs. He has gathered her up. My arm in yours, my hand in your pocket. You must walk, he laughs, with her hand in his pocket, as if in your dreams. And the dead who are long gone open up their mouths. Let us open up our lips. Let us show forth our star-blasted, dream-filled, white clover, yellow bed straw, milk wort. She opens her mouth to a dark field. She opens her mouth to a thousand leaves. She walks now in its shadow. Nettles, meadow grass. All now that has travelled between them. Sweat, semen, blood, milk. Tears. Leaf shadow touches grass shadow. A child mutters in the breakages of sleep. First you hear rain, and then you imagine it. She dances with him. Leaf shadow touches grass shadow. And you, Helen. She begins. When I walk with the white shock of an explosion. When I laugh, when I walk with their clean, white bones.
Thank you.
lights back on and putting the blind up. I have one question I wanted to ask Darren. When I asked you to give a title for your session, you talked about making the case for Helen Thomas, and I wondered if you could talk a little about that contested space. A lot of Edward Thomas's friends didn't agree, as I understand it, with what Helen wrote in her memoirs of how their relationship was. And I wondered if you could talk about that and about what happens between making a private grief public and taking your personal grief and how that changes and what part of the process it is when it becomes a public monument, like writing a published memoir.
Totally amazing question. Okay, so Helen's memoirs, she kind of hung on. So after 1917 to 1926, she managed. She was impoverished. I mean, the financial circumstances that she was left in, they were always really poor. But what did she have? She could take in boarders from the school. She had a very small widow's pension. It took her a long time to actually, I think she had a breakdown about 1925, 26, and the idea was that the book would be a way of her gathering herself back and actually, yes, writing down that history as a way of kind of putting herself back together again in a way. I think the books in the end became very valuable financially again because they did give her some income. And she became known as a writer. They sold very well. Not least because they are sexually quite frank. And she talks really, really interestingly about what it was like to be 17. She was born in 1877, so 17 years after that when she meets Edward Thomas, she's 17, 18. And really neither of them really knowing what they're doing with their bodies or themselves and she portrays Edward as the great innocent, actually. She's quite relaxed in herself and her sexuality, and he isn't at all. And I think Robert Frost took against this because it perhaps makes him less masculine than Frost would have wanted Edward the soldier, Edward the poet to have seen. So there's that problem, and you know, Frost and Helen really fell out. It's a hugely sad story, actually, where she meets him much later on, and then he can't bear to see her, and I don't think he's ever really liked her. And she realizes, of course, that Edward and Robert had this enormous, valuable friendship, and she wants part of Edward back from knowing Robert again, and it's very complicated. And I think that she kept it to Jenny and David, that it was kept to Jenny and David for so long, was a little sort of wall of protection between the Helen and Edwardness and the absolute personalness of it. What was the rest of the question?
That was pretty much it. But it was about her experience but also about the making something public that is private, which of course you've done yourself, as all writers do. But if I can ask if there are other questions while you... So maybe you could talk a little bit more then about the private and the personal, the monumentalising in the memorial process.
For me, or for her, or...
Either.
Well, books are very solid things, aren't they? And films are material, of course, too. But I think my sense of where I want to leave myself with Helen is definitely in the film because of its movements. And I think these things are never really fixed, much as we would like to fix them or have a fantasy of being able to fix them. You know, I can bang into that monument going into work every day, but actually it is one version of one act of heroism, isn't it? So I think I'm very pro this sense of us allowing those things to be quite fluid and to shift, really, because they do.
I say something about that? I was just thinking about those, you know, those very solid monuments, you know, that we build for memorialization. But of course, something about what you've done in this poem, and in fact all the work we'll probably hear today, is that it takes an event, whatever sort of event it is, and because it's a creative act, it symbolizes it, it makes meaning. And of course the meaning, you know, to somehow sort of touch what you were saying, the meaning gets imbued with not only the event, as you were talking about with this woman, but of course one's own personal understanding and the sort of movement, the creative movement, is somehow trying to kind of capture the truth. And that's what really makes it powerful. So I think the two things of the public and private can sort of sit beside each other. And in a way, they do talk to each other, but only to the person that's reading them. You know, you've then got to think about the reader, the viewer, and what they take from it. So something around that, I think.
The thing about the memoir, people have said, oh, you know, Helen's imagining this, she's papering over it, it was actually a terrible marriage, she's just trying to make it sound better than it was. I think she's very good at balancing the difficulties, and she doesn't erase them at all, and also the joys. But it was a moment when I read Eleanor Fargen's account of the night, the last night that they all had together, where she writes this amazing thing about them sort of being awake all night and saying goodbye to each other, and him wrapping her up in his coat and carrying her upstairs. Then you read Eleanor's account. It's a different story. It's a completely different story, and that was quite hard for me to then have to deal with, because in Helen's account, Eleanor isn't even there.
What is Eleanor's story perhaps?
It's just much less romantic. Helen was a great romantic, you know. She was sort of reading Emerson and. You know, Eleanor says, you know, it's the first time that Edward ever kissed me goodnight. I don't know what kind of kiss that was, but it was a tiny little house. I mean, I've kind of I've been to the house as well, and there's not much room for manoeuvre inside. So I think the panorama that she creates of this great carrying and unfolding and the children, it's all actually within this tiny little space, and there's also actually, you know, Eleanor there as a friend as well. So, and there's that dynamic between the three of them. Going on as well. It's, you know, Nick Dear's play captures some of that, those tensions between the three of them.
Then one last question before we break for coffee. No, in that case, we will return revived in half an hour. Thank you very much.